Good afternoon. Welcome again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're going to do something a little different for ourselves. We're going to follow a hypothetical woman, 45-year-old woman. We're going to call Ms. Johnson, and she's just been diagnosed with breast cancer. We're going to try to follow her from this initial diagnosis or suspicion of breast cancer through treatment and maybe even through some suggestions on reconstructive surgery if necessary. At each step, we're going to discuss her options and get recommendations and rationale for these recommendations from Anchorage breast surgeon Dr. Lori Bleicher and cancer specialist Dr. Jeannie Anderson. Because of the format of today's program, I'm going to ask listeners that not to send emails or questions. We want to be able to go through this whole sequence, and I think it will work better for all if we just bypass the question and series. Let me just go ahead and start then at this point and say thanks to Jeannie and Anderson and Dr. Bleicher for taking the time to be with us today. It's nice to see both of you.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
This was a program that was suggested during some previous conversations with, I think, some women talking about some female problem, may have been breast cancer in another format, but I think it's a way to see how the cooperation between physicians on a very serious illness happens and occurs, and also to get some ideas from real experts about these particular problems. I should mention before we get started that Dr. Anderson is the medical director of the Providence Cancer Center Research Department. She was trained at Yale as an undergraduate and MD degree at Stanford, and then has been very involved in clinical cancer research protocols and is works with numerous organizations, particularly in the Northwest, in these kinds of clinical cancer trials. Dr. Bleicher also has a connection with Yale, where she received her MD degree and then spent some time at Mount Sinai Hospital, even working as the attending surgeon in the breast clinic through 1976. And then she moved up here, and she's been a breast oncologic surgeon and a member of the American Society of Breast Surgeons since moving here. So let's take this patient, who I'm identifying as Ms. Johnson. She's 45 years old. She just had a mammogram, Dr. Bleicher, which suggests that she probably has a breast cancer. What is the next suggestion for her? What happens? Is she told to contact you or someone else, or does the radiologist contact you? What happens?
If the patient has a primary care physician, she's likely to obtain a clinical examination from that person at this time and then be directed to have an imaging-directed biopsy of the finding, particularly if it is not palpable to the primary care provider. If she has no primary care provider, the imaging services who obtain the mammogram that show the abnormality will likely speak with her directly and suggest to her that she see a surgeon and suggest to her that she undergo a biopsy promptly. Very often in this day and age when I see a patient, she has already had an imaging-directed biopsy at the imaging center, and I'm presented with a patient who has heard her diagnosis but nothing else and has a pathology report which tells me some details about the tumor.
So the purpose of the imaging-directed biopsy is to get a piece of tissue.
Yes, it gets a piece of tissue. It enables us to establish the diagnosis. Sometimes there are shadows that show up on mammography that turn out not to be cancer at all. So it's most important to have the diagnosis first thing. And if a patient comes to me for that clinical examination that I mentioned above and she has not yet had a biopsy, I will either perform it myself in the office if the lesion is large enough, or if it's non-palpable, send her back to the imaging center for an imaging-directed biopsy. But the important consultation has to start with the tissue diagnosis.
So the mammography, how precise is it in making the diagnosis or being highly suspicious of a diagnosis? It turns out, as most listeners must realize, that sometimes what's seen turns out not to be a cancer.
Yes. Well, it depends on what's seen. In The case of microcalcifications, which can signal the very beginnings of early breast cancer, when abnormal microcalcifications are seen, 85% of the time they're from a benign cause, and only 15% of the time are they from the very beginnings of breast cancer called ductal carcinoma in situ. If a mass is seen on the mammogram and the patient is then directed to proceed to an ultrasound, there is a higher likelihood that if it looks like cancer, it will turn out to be cancer. Masses are a little bit easier to characterize on mammography and improved with the addition of ultrasound, so that a lot more than 15% of them that look like cancer will prove to be cancer, probably three-quarters of them. Mammography does not see all cancers, however, so clinical breast examination is still an important aspect.
And I guess it may be at this time it's worth mentioning that it is true that you could have a mammogram that was entirely normal and still have very shortly thereafter develop a very bad cancer that could be pretty life-threatening before another mammogram even comes around.
Yes, this would be what's called an interval cancer. Mm-hmm. And if there's absolutely no clinical finding or mammogram finding at 1 month, mm-hmm. and several months later, there is a large finding, it's likely to be a very, very aggressive type of lesion. But the other thing that happens is that the patient has an abnormality at the time she goes for mammogram, but keeps it to herself because of the wish that it really isn't anything important. The mammogram doesn't pick it up. That will happen probably 10% of the time. And if the patient doesn't share with her primary care provider that she's acknowledged the presence of a lump, the diagnosis may be delayed. There are a few kinds of cancers that are hard to see mammographically, so that it's my belief that the very worst aspect of the patient's concern should be pursued. If she feels a lump and it doesn't show on mammogram, pursue that. If she has a normal clinical examination but the mammogram looks abnormal, pursue that.
Do we have any idea how long a cancer has been present at the time it is typically been present by the time it's typically diagnosed? Is that an impossible thing to answer? If it is, are we at a point where we think many of them have been around quite a while before they're really diagnosed?
People have done bench research on this subject, and when you take into account cell doubling times, it is said that from the time of the first cell mutation to the time of having a 1 centimeter, which is about a third of an inch, lesion, it's somewhere between 2 and 8 years.
Mm-hmm. What's then done with the tissue that's obtained at the biopsy?
Well, first it is placed in formaldehyde to fix it and harden it and sent over to the pathology department. They cut it into microscopic sections and place it on slides and stain it. They look at the slides created under a microscope and make a diagnosis, presence or absence of cancer. If cancer is seen and there is adequate tissue, doesn't have to be very much, additional indices will be obtained. The pathologist will stain the tissue to see if it's sensitive to estrogen and progesterone. In other words, if there are receptor sites on the surface of the tumor cells for estrogen and progesterone, and also another called HER2-new, which is an epidermal growth factor receptor site on the surface of cells. So those three particulars will be done routinely immediately upon receiving the diagnosis of cancer.
Dr. Anderson, why do we do these biological testing on these cancers?
Well, it helps to subcategorize the type of cancer. It gives us more prognostic information as to how we expect patient will do, as the natural history of the cancer would be. And that also helps us with treatment options. With all both hormone-sensitive tumors and HER2-new positive tumors, we have what's called targeted therapy. So we have additional treatment that's targeted against the estrogen receptor and against the HER2 receptor to help improve outcome and decrease relapse rates.
So what I heard you say, I'm Ms. Johnson here, and I'm thinking about what you're saying is, so these tests give me some idea of my prognosis in response to therapy.
That's right.
And it seemed like I remember reading, Ms. Johnson says, that triple negatives are not good.
Right. Just to define that for the listeners, triple negative means the markers estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 are all three negative. Mm-hmm. And those are generally more aggressive tumors. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the estrogen receptor and progesterone receptors and HER2 are really, they're proteins sitting on the cell surface that are receptors for estrogen and progesterone and this HER2.
New.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the absence of those increases the likelihood that this is a more difficult cancer to treat.
Correct.
Is it then true that if all three receptors are there, that it's easier to treat? Or we don't know.
We
are
generally have
too many other factors.
Well, it means treatment is longer.
Okay.
There's more medical therapies to offer, and in general, it does result in lower relapse rates overall. But it depends on other factors that I'm sure we'll get to as we talk. Prognosis is also dependent on size of the tumor, lymph node involvement. That really basically tells us the stage. So stage and these markers are also important.
So if I'm Mrs. Johnson and I'm really skeptical and I ask this question, is it crazy? What are the chances that this diagnosis of cancer by this pathologist at Providence is wrong?
Chances are nil. I would like to say nil. We have an excellent pathology department at Providence Hospital with six members in the department. And when they have a cancer diagnosis, they share the slides. It's already a situation where multiple opinions have coalesced. If there is any disagreement among them, it is worked out before a diagnosis is rendered. So by the time the patient has been told that she has cancer, I am sure it is absolutely correct.
Anything else we need to know before you speak to Ms. Johnson about what's going to happen next?
Well, when I meet Mrs. Johnson, I've got a lot to do before I say what's going to happen next. First of all, I have to deal with the fact that she's very frightened. I have to put her at ease. I take a history from her, learning details about her general health, her reproductive life, how many children she has, et cetera, her medications, her other illnesses, and very important, her family history and whether breast cancer or other related cancers form any type of pattern among her blood relatives. Then I examine her, I review her images, and then I sit her down and talk to her about her options. I explain that the treatment of breast cancer is a team affair, and I show her a list of all the colleagues that I work with in town, the medical oncologists like Dr. Anderson, the radiation oncologist, and the genetics counselor. Mrs. Anderson, at the age of 45, would be advised to confer with the genetics counselor because a young woman presenting with a breast cancer diagnosis is more likely than a postmenopausal woman to have a breast cancer gene mutation. After we've settled who else she will confer with, then I try to set a plan of attack. And by the time the patient leaves my office, she should have appointments established with other consultants and a target date for surgery. If additional imaging is required, additional x-ray pictures, those are established also. But the next thing that I do is show the patient an anatomy picture, a breast anatomy, a little cartoon of the pathology of a duct and a milk lobule, and what the cancer looks like growing in the duct. And then I explain the pathology report to her. When we get the pathology report, besides the estrogen, progesterone receptors, HER2-new, and the type of tissue, we also get from the pathologist something called grade, which is a 1, 2, or 3 number, depending on whether it looks like a bland sort of tumor that's not very rapidly growing, or a medium tumor, and most fall into the medium category, or a very aggressive tumor where under the microscope the pathologist can see many cells all at the same time dividing. So those are the details that the patient has to ingest. And it can be a rapid process. Some patients come to this encounter having read an awful lot on the subject already, and they may be sort of scientifically directed themselves, and you can speak fast. Other patients have no idea about the natural history of breast cancer or anything about the details of treatment, and you have to go very slowly. The important thing is to make the patient feel comfortable so that she's not confused and the frightened thoughts that are whirling around in her head stop. The next thing I would do would be discuss the local options and mention the systemic options. And I try to make the point that radiation and surgery are two ways of treating the tumor locally, and they work together very often. So that's the way to improve the breast health, to get the tumor out of the breast, to cure it from coming back in the breast. And systemic treatment, which is what Dr. Anderson provides, is directed at the remainder of the body, in case there are any possibility of micrometastasis, these may very well be eradicated. Sometimes the systemic treatment is initiated first because the tumor is extremely large and one can't quite imagine doing surgery immediately on it without getting it in a shrinking mode. That's upfront chemotherapy or hormonal therapy called neoadjuvant. In that case, and that's not too common, the medical oncologist would be brought into the discussion immediately. Otherwise, the only person the patient has to see before surgery is the radiation oncologist. And that's because we have to design what's going to be done in the operating room, the extent of surgery, that if breast conservation is on the table, the type of radiation that will be directed, and those influences the way the surgery is done.
Let me remind our listeners just quickly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and what we're doing today is we're following a hypothetical 45-year-old woman from the diagnosis of breast cancer through treatment. My guests are Anchorage breast surgeon Dr. Lori Breischer and oncologist Jeannie Anderson. At this point, we have made a presumptive diagnosis. We've got a biopsy, and we're talking about our surgical options. And as we're doing this process today, I've elected not to take emails or phone calls about this particular program today. I would direct you to alaskapublic.org, hit the Line 1 link, and you will find several very good and detailed, reliable links on breast cancer, including a wonderful video program that can also mimic what we're doing today and follow a woman through treatment with an opportunity at that website even to ask questions along the line. So we've got this diagnosis, and I haven't heard much more about the kind of surgery. I'm still thinking that I've got an option between a mam, having my breast removed and just removing the tumor, and what about possible lymph nodes under my arm? When do we discuss those options?
Right now. As soon as I make it clear to the patient that systemic decisions are likely to be carried out by Dr. Anderson after surgery is done, then the next thing that I do is go back to a long discussion of surgical options. And breast conservation therapy has moved to be the standard of care, whereas 25 years ago, 35 years ago when I trained, mastectomy was the standard of care. But there is usually an option for breast conservation therapy. Most patients are quite happy to hear that. This would require resection of the removal of the tumor in its entirety with a small rim of normal tissue around it for safety purposes to assure most likely you weren't leaving tumor cells behind, to be followed later by some type of radiation therapy. That suffices to treat the breast. The lymph node investigation is for purposes of staging, so that the goals of surgery are to get rid of the tumor and obtain staging information so that we can refine our concept of that particular patient's prognosis. And it used to be that complete axillary lymph node dissection, in other words, removing many, many underarm lymph nodes, was required for staging purposes. But happily, for about 15 years now, I've been performing a sentinel lymph node biopsy, which means making a map and the time of surgery, on the very same day of surgery, to designate which lymph nodes are physically the first ones to receive lymph flow from the breast, and removing those only. Only if there are many of them and they are all diseased with tumor or grossly involved with tumor would one then proceed to removing a lot more lymph nodes. And this is a sound new concept that came out about a year ago in an excellent prospectively performed research trial.
So what that means is now at the time of surgery, the lymph nodes are looked at that you take out, and a decision can be made right then how aggressive to be about the remaining potential lymph nodes in that area?
Yes, it can be done that way, although in the absence of numerous suspicious lymph nodes or a grossly involved lymph node, I would probably defer to the permanent section, which comes out 2 days later.
Okay.
So most of the time now, one does not proceed to a vigorous lymph node removal.
Okay.
This is different if prior to doing surgery, imaging studies or clinical examination showed you a big bulky lymph node and you had biopsy proof that it was involved. Then a different approach with removal of more lymph nodes is appropriate at the initial surgery.
So what's the likely findings now? Let's assume Ms. Johnson is, you know, I picked this lady because I don't know anything about breast cancer. I'm just assuming it's a pretty common story. What's the likelihood of the next thing is seeing Dr. Or what's the next thing? Is it Dr. Anderson, a medical oncologist? Is it the radiologist you mentioned?
Yes. Well, the radiation oncologist, the patient has already seen before surgery because I need to make certain that they don't uncover any suspicious other illnesses that would preclude using radiation therapy. Certain connective tissue disorders make radiation therapy a bad idea, such as scleroderma. These are pretty rare, and I would likely have figured that out already. But the other thing is the patient should be comfortable with the concept of radiation, and most of the time they become comfortable with the concept of radiation. So I have to know that the patient will accept radiation. If I'm going to the operating room to perform only what's nicknamed lumpectomy, mm-hmm. tumor removal, I need a commitment from the patient that she will follow that with whole breast or partial breast irradiation. So that's been done already. At the end of surgery, we have obtained enough information for the pathologist to finalize the diagnosis and make sure the entire tumor is uniform throughout, to tell me how the edges are, to make certain that one of them didn't microscopically get approached by tumor, even though grossly it seemed to be far away, and to obtain the final pathology and the lymph nodes. With that information in hand, the patient is ready to see the medical oncologist and have a decision made about systemic treatment. And most of the time, radiation therapy doesn't proceed until a decision is made about systemic treatment or not.
One more thing before I get to Dr. Anderson. I'm not sure how to ask this question. Taking the breast off is generally not something that's necessary today. Most of the time it's a lumpectomy, or is it really depend on the extent and the size of the tumor, I guess?
I'd like to say that most of the time it's not necessary, but sometimes the patient may demand a mastectomy. Sometimes the patient may request a bilateral mastectomy.
Often, for example, if they were had a genetic predisposition,
if they had a genetic
risk,
they had a genetic predisposition, and that's why the genetics counselor may figure in immediately, because genetics consultation and gene testing can be accomplished within, say, 10 days or so, and the surgery can await the obtaining those results. If the patient has a very suggestive family history for a BRCA gene mutation, even if she doesn't have one, if 5 out of 6 female relatives have had breast or ovarian cancer, even if she tests negative, she may request a bilateral mastectomy, and it's not an unreasonable approach, but you have to distinguish between what is necessary to treat the tumor you know about already and a broad preemptive strike. Right. In other words, prophylactic surgery to remove areas that may develop breast cancer later. The average patient has a 10 to 15% lifetime risk of getting a second breast cancer. A patient with a gene mutation may have a 20 to 80% risk of getting a second breast cancer. So you can see where the patient with a given gene mutation might really want more surgery than another patient.
How about a patient with a BRCA abnormality asking for the ovaries to be removed at the same time? Is that something that's reasonable?
It's reasonable. It's probably, we probably don't love combining the two surgeries because either one of them can be challenging to recover from, and if you do them both at the same time, it really puts the patient at a disadvantage for an easy convalescence. But I think with a BRCA gene mutation, ovary removal is definitely under consideration, and it's probably even more important than prophylactic breast removal because we don't have accurate screening tests for ovarian cancer the way we have screening tests for breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dr. Anderson. So this patient is now coming in and has been referred by Dr. Blasher to you. What do you want to do different or know about or find out?
Well, usually when the patient first comes into my office, I try not to assume that they know a lot. Some people may have been educated. Some people may have heard things and forgotten things. So I, after doing similar to Dr. Blasher, a standard history and physical exam, then and reviewing all the records, then I sit down with the patient and I usually prefer it if there's another person there so they have a second pair of ears to hear all the information. When we talk, we go review the pathology report, and that gives us information on the stage of the tumor, the prognostic features, the predictive markers that we've talked about. So Dr. Blasher has mentioned size, lymph node involvement, the grade of the tumor, how aggressive it appears to be, and then these additional markers, estrogen, progesterone receptor, and HER2-NU. I also talk to the patient about whether they've got any symptoms that would suggest that the cancer spread outside the local and regional area. And many patients kind of wonder whether or not they should be getting scans to look for distant disease, which we refer to as either metastatic or stage 4 disease. And just a comment on that, in general, if a patient does not have any symptoms to suggest advanced disease and there's nothing on exam that is worrisome, or screening blood work, we usually do not do additional scans. The time that we might is if they have many positive lymph nodes, for instance, 4 or more. That would suggest there's a higher chance. And when breast cancer spreads, the places that it's more common to spread to would be bone, liver, lung, and then less common, but possibly to the brain. But often if you have a patient, for instance, with stage 1 breast cancer, you don't want to do staging studies because if they have no symptoms, they're more likely that it's going to be a negative scan or a scan that has a false positive rather than a true positive. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you're chasing yourself with an abnormality that's not really cancer, but that it requires more tests, possibly even a biopsy, and that delays the time to further treatment and provides a lot of anxiety to patients.
And I'm going to ask Dr. Johnson, or Dr. Anderson, you know this because studies have shown that that seems to be the most effective way to approach this situation. It's not your opinion necessarily.
Correct, correct. What I'm commenting on are actually the national guidelines.
Right.
The national guidelines say that stage 1 and 2, you do not do routine studies to look for metastatic disease unless there's a clinical picture that makes it worrisome. Right. Okay. So those are national guidelines.
Right.
So then I review with the patient what the different stages are, again, you know, telling them things that they probably have already heard. And then with the information we have on an individual patient, we try to estimate for that patient what their risk is of relapse, meaning relapse either in the breast or relapse in distant sites. And if a cancer relapses in the breast, there's a pretty good chance that with additional surgery, possibly radiation, they can still be cured of the cancer. But if the cancer comes back in another part of the body and it's metastatic disease, although it's treatable and patients can live for a while, a number of years with it, it's not curable. So the number that we really want to focus on when we're making medical decision in my office is what's the risk of distant spread of the cancer? And then with medical treatment, you know, either chemotherapy or targeted therapy, what can we decrease that risk of relapse down to? And then the decision-making is that improvement in outcome with a medication, is that benefit worth the risk of the treatment? So it's a very lengthy decision-making process with the patient and family members to review the risk of recurrence, the improvement with outcome with treatment, what the side effects of treatment are, and then put it all together and make a final decision.
So I'm assuming you're talking about it may be different for a 80-year-old woman versus a 35-year-old woman.
Right. So our decision-making depends not only on the characteristics of the tumor, but the medical characteristics of patients, so that includes age, what other medical illnesses they have,
right.
And then also their preferences.
Right.
I see patients very often with, for instance, a stage one tumor that has a good prognosis but still has some risk of relapse, for instance, maybe 10 or 15%. And we can do some additional pathology tests. An example is something called Oncotype DX, which helps segregate the overall relatively good prognosis patients into not as good and quite good. And then we can tell them, well, with chemotherapy, the difference in your risk of relapse might be 3 or 4 or 5%. One woman will look at that and say, that's worth it. I want chemo. One woman will look at that and say, goodness, that's not worth it. I don't want the side effects. So what a patient's preferences and their outlook on life influences the decision.
Yeah, this sounds easier than I'm sure it is, because some patients, frankly, at this point, may not even understand what 3 to 5% means, and other patients say, "Doc, what do you want me to do?" But the point is, today you try to educate this patient as best you can on her specific situation with this particular tumor and everything we can find about it, and give her some treatment options and see what she's leaning towards as well as she can understand what the options are.
That's right. But as you said, many patients want to defer to the physician,
right,
and are a little bit confused or it's overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to rely on a number of factors. One, what a prior clinical trial show. Is there truly a difference, what's considered a scientifically proven difference in outcome that mm-hmm. favors using treatment? And also, you know, what are some of the national guidelines? I've referred to that. We've got well-publicized national guidelines, one of which is through something called the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which is an alliance, I think, of 13 academic centers where they have experts that give opinions or recommendations based on evidence of how to treat patients. So we often will rely on those recommendations. So when a patient, you know, wants to defer back to us, then we go generally based on clinical trial results, national guidelines, and our own assessment of the patient.
Let's assume, and you have to tell us, Mrs. Johnson's 45, and she's got how many of the markers present? She's otherwise perfectly healthy. She's got a number of years of potentially healthy life. She's got no other health care problems. What are her outcomes likely to be under various treatment options, and what are the risks or side effects?
The majority of patients are diagnosed with breast cancer now at an early stage.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I asked the Providence Cancer Registry to give me some of the numbers,
mm-hmm.
And just to give people a little bit of idea that in Alaska, I think the number of cases of breast cancer per year is 400, 450 in that range. We haven't mentioned yet what ductal carcinoma in situ is, but that's also referred to as a stage zero breast cancer. It's just isolated to the breast and has not had a chance to spread outside the ducts. And that's about 20% of the cases. Those patients, it's inappropriate to give chemotherapy. And then the remaining...
Because
there's no risk, essentially. You know, you can never say 100%.
This is after surgery.
Localized treatment.
Yeah,
there's essentially
okay.
No risk at this point that there could be micrometastases in another part of the body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But stage one and stage two, which is localized to the breast, relatively small in size, or only 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes, the stage one and two is the vast majority of what we call invasive breast cancers that we see. And those patients have an excellent prognosis. Over the next 5 to 10 years, I'd say in some range of 85 to 90% or higher are alive. You know, years ago, when patients were diagnosed at higher stage, there was a higher risk of relapse and a higher risk of dying of breast cancer. So now, you know, one thing to reassure many patients is most patients are picked up with an early stage. They have a very good prognosis. and are likely to live a long time and not relapse. Am I answering your questions? Yep. There's a number that were in that.
But I'm also need to take a short break here. I appreciate that. I've got caught up and I didn't take my usual break. So I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line One, your health connection in Anchorage, Alaska. After this short break, we're going to continue to discuss breast cancer with Anchorage breast surgeon Dr. Lori Bleicher and medical oncologist Jeannie Anderson. You're listening to Line One, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line One on alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA FM 91.1.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're doing something different. We're taking a hypothetical woman, a 45-year-old with breast cancer, and we're discussing the treatment options with Dr. Lori Bleicher, a breast surgeon from here in Anchorage, and a medical oncologist, Jeannie Anderson, also from Anchorage. So because of this format, we are not taking emails, we are not taking phone calls. I would remind you, you can re-listen to this program in its entirety beginning at 7 o'clock tonight on KSKA, that's 91.1 on the FM dial, and at any time, you can go to alaskapublic.org, you can hit the Line 1 link, and you can look and listen to the program. So there's no reason why you can't listen to the whole broadcast. Also, I would mention if you go to alaskapublic.org and hit the Line 1 link, you can go to the recommended links from this program today, which have variable amounts of depth into the issue of breast cancer. So, Jeannie, we are talking about some outcomes, as I recall. We were saying it's about 400, 450 women in Alaska diagnosed with breast cancer. 20% of these are stage zero or ductal, which really don't need much else other than the tumor area removed. And that now stage one and stage two, there's a 5 to 10 year survival rate, 85 to 90%. Please correct me if I'm wrong about that. So one of the things I suspect is important to get across is how much better the outcome is, and partly that's because of earlier diagnosis, more early disease, but also I have to assume that there must be better, we have better ammunition.
Mm-hmm. It is earlier. I think mammography picks up tumors at an earlier stage when patients have their annual mammogram. We're picking up earlier tumors, including the ductal carcinoma in situ. So that's one reason for what we call stage migration towards lower stage tumors. We are getting better at treating them. I would say with let me mention what the main treatment options are, and then I can tell you where our main advances are. Chemotherapy, we're making some advances, but I'd say the rate of change with improvement with chemotherapy, we're sort of reaching up to a point of where we can't really get better at chemotherapy. Hormonal therapy or anti-estrogen treatment has been around for 30 years or so or more, and we've made some improvement in that with additional anti-estrogen drugs available. The area that we've made significant improvement in is adding in an additional targeted therapy in the subset of patients who have the HER2-new positive tumors, and that's about 20 to 25% of patients, where historically those were aggressive tumors. We would give chemotherapy, but they'd still have high relapse rates. There's now targeted therapy, meaning in this situation, drugs that are specifically work against the receptor with relatively minimal toxicity, so we can add that into chemotherapy without really adding significant increased risk to the patient, and it's reduced relapse rates, a relative improvement of 50%. So if the relapse rate previously had been, for instance, 30%, it's now about 15% when we add in the targeted therapy. And so we anticipate continued improvement with treatment of breast cancer as we get smarter at understanding the molecular basis and can develop more targeted therapies that are safer.
Side effects.
The main side effects depend on which drug you're talking about. So in patients who have advanced stage, and when I say advanced, I mean more typically stage 2 or stage 3 in some of the high-risk stage 1 patients where we're giving chemotherapy, then there's a long list of toxicities that we talk with about the patient. The ones that I'd say, the key points that I'd mention to patients is most side effects are reversible. Most side effects we can help them get through. We've seen most of them, and with good supportive care, we can keep it to a mild to moderate side effects that they have to deal with. But there are some symptoms that can be persistent. Some patients will get some cognitive dysfunction where they feel that they don't have as good a memory and recall as they used to, and that will improve after chemotherapy, but there may be a small residual side effect of that does not recover. Some people will get a little bit of nerve damage that sometimes does not fully recover. But symptoms like your hair loss and nausea, vomiting, those will recover. Fatigue is not uncommon during treatment, and we do recommend with patients that if they stay active, and one thing that I push for my patients a lot is to recommend exercise, that can help decrease some of the side effects during chemotherapy and improve, you know, their general feeling of well-being.
Anywhere along this line up to now, is there a time when you are going to pick up the phone and call somebody at Fred Hutchinson or something else, or you're going to recommend that this woman consider a clinical trial, and why would that be?
Well, I'm going to answer what I thought you were asking with the first question, and then I'll get to the comment about clinical trials. But I think the first question sounded to me like you're asking, do we get input from other physicians?
Yeah.
And I'd like to take this moment to just mention that when any of the physicians who work with patients with breast cancer in our community have questions, the first resource that's really an excellent one is to go to a group of physicians who see a lot of breast cancer patients, and twice a month we have what we call a multidisciplinary breast cancer conference where we gather with
In town.
It's held over at Providence, but any of the physicians in town can participate in the conference. The pathologists and radiologists come. We review the cases, and then we have all the different physicians involved in taking care of the patients who will spend 10, 15 minutes going over an individual patient, sometimes longer if it's complicated. And that's a way that a patient can get a second opinion from multiple medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and surgeons without having to spend more money or go out of town.
So basically, you've presented that case to a bunch of other professionals who are doing this for a living to get their 10 cents worth. I'm always interested in the opinion versus the evidence. And I are you asking people because this is a situation that is outside the norm where we don't have some standard protocols, or is it just to see if other people, given this particular group of symptoms, feels like we ought to think about going outside of a protocol? You understand what I'm saying?
Well, some patients are very straightforward, and we kind of can predict that our colleagues are going to say, well, of course that's what you should do. It's very routine. Some patients, there will be a little bit of a twist. There'll be something unusual, and that's not uncommon. Every patient is unique, and not everyone fits into one of these really standard categories. And then we'll also present patients if a patient requests it and would like to know that other physicians have put some thoughtful input into the care of their case.
So a patient has hepatitis C, might throw a ringer in.
That might be a good reason to bring it up. Or if there's multiple tumors in the breast, or if there's bilateral breast cancer, or there's some discrepant results from the pathology, for instance.
Okay.
And then you also commented, we will call outside down to the lower 48. For instance, when our colleagues in town say, boy, that's unusual, let's get somebody who sees only breast cancer in an academic institution. Regarding clinical trials, we don't terribly often call outside of the state for clinical trial availability, mainly because unless a patient has a really life-threatening breast cancer, it's probably not worth their while to go out of state for a clinical trial. But we do have a number of clinical trials available in Anchorage for patients with breast cancer, probably in the range of about 10 active clinical trials.
And these are national trials, which are open in town and which mm-hmm. you can put patients in, but it is a national trial.
Right, exactly. What Dr. Bleicher is mentioning is that there are national studies that we participate in, sometimes international studies we have available.
So it would theoretically, you're getting the same care on those trials as you would at Houston, at MD Anderson, or at Fred Hutchinson or something.
Well, I'd say they're getting better care because they can stay at home.
Ah, okay. Okay. But outcomes predictably
should be
the same.
Right. Yeah. In general, the outcomes with the patients treated at Anchorage, I think, are going to be equal mm-hmm. to anywhere on the lower 48.
Okay. All right. And you can monitor that. That's part of the trials, I suspect, is seeing how outcomes are. And if somebody has a particularly good series of outcomes, then we want to know what they're doing.
Right.
Maybe a little differently. Okay.
Correct.
Okay. What else do we need to talk about? We haven't brought in the radiation oncologist anymore. Is that something?
Right.
That,
well, one thing I guess I'd mention is the sequence of events. So Dr. Bleicher has already mentioned once surgery is done, they've often have seen a radiation oncologist. That's sort of put on the back burner when they're referred to the medical oncologist. We make the decision up front about whether or not chemotherapy is going to be given because the general sequence is surgery, then chemotherapy, then radiation, and then we go on to, if it's a hormone-sensitive tumor, on to anti-estrogen therapy. So if chemotherapy is done, then that's completed. There are some data that are emerging that I'm really actually not familiar with yet about possibly combining chemotherapy and radiation, but in general it's felt that should be done sequentially.
It used to be done together, and the skin toxicity was worse, so one has to be very careful. It depends on the agents of chemotherapy. The only mm-hmm. exception to that sequence does cover most patients, it is the patient who's eligible for what's called partial breast irradiation, which is a relatively new technique of administering radiation only to the tumor bed and about a centimeter around the tumor bed. It's limited to patients with the most common type of breast cancer pathology, invasive ductal, because we don't have knowledge of using it in other pathologies. It's limited to patients with negative lymph nodes because that means you don't have to conceptualize that there could be tumor cells in transit in the lymphatic system between the location of the tumor and the armpit. So it's a select kind of patient. But in the patient who's eligible for that, the radiation treatment can be accomplished in about 5 days and can be squeezed in during the healing period before the medical oncologist has even completed her decision-making process. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if it's going to be whole breast radiation, it takes 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, or 5 weeks, depending on the recipe, and is best postponed until the end of chemotherapy.
Do you, as a medical oncologist, have to make a comment, or do you feel like you should make a comment about these genetically predisposed BRCA example, which I understand are maybe 10%, they're the minority of the breast cancers. Is that come into your discussion with the patients very much at this point?
Once a patient has breast cancer, the prognosis for that cancer is really dependent on all the features that we've mentioned. Why they've developed the breast cancer, for instance, being BRCA positive or other risk factors such as never having children, obesity, perhaps alcohol intake, things like that. The causative factors are really not important for the most part in making an assessment of prognosis and what treatment options. But for instance, whether or not mastectomy is going to be done or prophylactic surgery is going to be done is a second separate issue.
Lori, I want to bring you back in now, if it seems appropriate. We're down to about less than 10 minutes, and so I want to talk about reconstruction options for women who've had some surgery done for reconstruction and so forth. What needs to be said about that?
First of all, reconstruction is usually reserved for the patient who underwent a mastectomy or bilateral mastectomy. There are a few published techniques for improving the appearance of a lumpectomy, but generally, if the surgeon is careful, when I perform a lumpectomy, I don't think my patients need reconstruction. With care, the cosmetic outcome of a localized breast resection is excellent. So we're talking about mastectomy patients. The reconstruction options are basically in two categories, implant reconstruction, and tissue transfer operations. Implant reconstruction is conceptually the simplest thing. An implant is placed behind the chest wall muscle because the skin's not strong enough to support it. An implant's placed behind the chest wall muscle, which serves to round out and create a protuberance referred to as the breast mound. And then at a later time, nipple areola reconstruction can be done with a combination of tattooing and mobilization of little pieces of skin to make a bump. This ends up sounding an awful lot more realistic than you can get from this description. It's an excellent and simple technique, which doesn't violate any other areas of the body that haven't already been involved in surgery. On the other hand, it doesn't work for everyone and is particularly difficult to do if radiation has already happened. For instance, in the patient who had breast cancer, was treated with a lumpectomy, had radiation, and then years down the road developed a new cancer in the same breast, she is not eligible for a second course of radiation. The skin won't tolerate it. It's not done. So then her options are either just doing a tumor removal, which is a little bit controversial. Data is accumulating, but the standard would be proceeding then with a mastectomy. So there you're doing a mastectomy in someone who's already had radiation. And the classic teaching for this patient is that reconstruction is best accomplished by moving tissue from the lower abdomen or the back and placing it in the front of the chest to create fullness, bring new blood supply, and new skin. So those are the reconstruction options. They're all available by some by myself, some by plastic surgeons here in Anchorage, and the opportunities for reconstruction are here.
Should we mention anything else about what we'll call survivorship issues? And one that comes to my mind is what's the is there a risk from chemotherapy? We already established that there's a risk for second cancers as a baseline, assuming you don't even have the genetic predisposition that we've recognized now. But does the mere treatment with radiotherapy, with chemotherapy, increase the likelihood over and above the background radiation rate for another cancer?
That's a good question. Regarding radiation, the numbers are changing because the radiation oncologists are getting better at their techniques and the fields that they use. So the published data are inaccurate for the current techniques. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very hard to estimate what the risk is of a radiation-induced cancer.
Right.
Our radiation colleagues say it's extremely small.
Right. Okay.
Regarding chemotherapy, the unfortunate one statistic I do need to mention to patients, depending on what chemotherapy regimen we use, but there is a risk of secondary leukemia with some of our chemotherapy regimens, but that risk is no more than a 0.5%, so it's very small.
Okay.
So I think second tumors are, it is very important, however, that when we see patients with one cancer, we need to give them advice about what monitoring and screening they should do for other common cancers. So in my patient population, I'm always reminding them that they need to be up to date on their GYN, their gynecological cancer screening, colon cancer screening once patients are over age 50 for the most part. Both of those are very important. I personally recommend vitamin D supplements, which is very probably not controversial anymore. It's probably not the only thing that contributes to cancer risk, but there are associations with low vitamin D levels and increased risk for cancers. And in our Alaska climate, we don't get much sun exposure.
And I might as well throw in, and I'll see if you say, yeah, but you don't want to take too much either. I think the rate of return starts dropping after certain amounts.
Probably. That's probably a whole nother show that you could have.
All right.
I would like to mention a little bit about surveillance.
Sure.
Is that something
that
might be a good idea to talk about now? When we're done with the chemotherapy and patients are now done with all the intensive treatment and they're really trying to get their lives back to normal, my recommendations are encouraging routine exercise. If they're overweight, losing weight does help reduce relapse rates, and so we recommend that. And then patients generally ask, well, what kind of tests are going to be done? How do we know that there's not any cancer there? And for the most part, we really can't tell the patient that they're completely cancer-free. We can generally give them prognostic information and then tell them about what symptoms and things to look for to let us know about. But from a standpoint of really medical interventions for surveillance, mammography, Seeing the physicians in follow-up for physical exam is important. But we don't do blood tests to look for metastatic breast cancer or do CAT scans unless there's symptoms. And those, again, are following national guidelines, and they really don't add to the patient's longevity or well-being to do a lot of extra medical tests that are unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. I think it's been shown that weight loss and exercise each individually improve the prognosis of breast cancer. And Alaskan women, unfortunately, are a little bit higher in their body mass index than the national average, so that weight loss is a very important counseling issue. There is available in town oncology rehab, which is an exercise program that helps a patient recover from surgery and chemotherapy, but also establishes in them a routine of exercise that's very good to incorporate into daily living.
We have about 3 minutes. If there's other comments about the treatment, this time I'd like to ask you to say that. But also perhaps prevention, what do we know? Is there anything we should share about preventing breast cancer?
Interesting. In high-risk patients, probably high-risk patients without breast cancer or high-risk patients presumably cured from their first breast cancer, anti-estrogen therapy actually has a risk reduction effect for acquiring a second breast cancer. I think nationwide and in Alaska as well, the use of an agent such as tamoxifen or for postmenopausal women, another one called aromacin, as a risk reduction strategy, both of these are anti-estrogen medications, the use of these is probably underutilized. It takes a long time to counsel a patient who doesn't have cancer, who's at an elevated risk for developing such, that she would benefit from an anti-estrogen treatment. And that's probably the sole reason why the treatments are underutilized. But they have been shown statistically to really lower the future breast cancer rate by 50 to 65%, so that I think these should be used. Mm-hmm. And then we have weight loss and exercise.
Good comments. Dr. Anderson?
The only other comment I'd make is that even when you do spend time talking to patients about taking tamoxifen, they are concerned about side effects, and sometimes because the decrease in risk doesn't translate into a difference in survival, don't always choose it.
Mm-hmm. So the last 30 seconds or so, any final comments?
Well, just that I think you've heard from the discussion that we've mentioned all the available services here in Anchorage. It used to be that a patient would present and say, doctor, should I go to Seattle for my care or MD Anderson for my care? I think clearly we have excellent breast imaging. We have pathology. We have radiation oncology. We have medical oncology. We have surgery. We have reconstructive surgery. We have oncology rehab, genetics testing, counseling, support groups, and even the Susan Butcher Center for kids whose mothers have had cancer. Okay. So I think we've got the disease covered here with services.
Well, listen, this has been what I hoped we would accomplish, so I want to say thanks very much to Dr. Anderson and Dr. Bleicher for taking the time.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You bet. If the listeners would like to contribute or continue with today's conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that at alaskapublic.org. You can join us it's going to be 2 weeks. I think it's on the 27th at 2 p.m. when we're going to be talking about hip replacement implants, which are being recalled. They're failing prematurely and they're loosening prematurely. We're going to be discussing these problems with Anchorage orthopedic surgeon Dr. Steve Tower and Dartmouth biomedical engineer John Currier. Pat Yak is vice president of public media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks very much for taking the time to listen. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.